Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to Talking About Platforms. My name is Philip Meyer. I'm here with my regular co-host Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Philip. Hi, everyone.
And we have Panos Constantinidis with us, who is a professor of digital innovation at Alliance Manchester Business School. He's a fellow of the Cambridge Digital Innovation Center and one of the co-founders of the European Digital Platforms Research Network. Hi, Panos. Great to have you.
Hi, Philip. Hi, Daniel. Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's open with our usual question. The podcast is titled Talking About Platforms. That's what get together the people that are actually coming here. And my first question for you is, what is a platform to you? Because we know that we are all talking about it, but it's not obvious that we all refer to the same thing. And even getting a bit more personal, how you end up studying platforms and talking about them.
Sure. Well, I have to say that I didn't start as a platform researcher. Even though I did research that was quite, I would say, in parallel to what other people were doing in relation to platforms. So I entered the world of platforms quite late, I would say. And my research originally focused on information or digital infrastructures, focusing primarily on problems of collective action and drawing on the work of Elinor Ostrom and her ideas around governing common pool resources. That's that's my interest in the topic, which I think a lot of people have talked about collective action problems in the context of platforms, you know, solving two-sided or multi-sided problems on different types of platforms. And what happened was, it's an interesting story because I was involved in this working group that organized a workshop on innovations in information infrastructure. And we organized one at the Warwick Business School back in 2015. And this was primarily attended by people from information systems, which is where I come from. The tradition was always that at the end of these workshops, we would go after a special issue at a journal. And previously, there were other special issues carried in other journals. This time around, together with Ulla Henfrinsen, we started talking and we said, okay, maybe we need to do things a little bit different this time and try to invite people from other disciplines, because obviously others are talking about some of the issues that we're talking about. So we said, okay, let's invite Jeff Parker to join our editorial board. And that was, I think, the best decision we've ever made, because that opened up so many different opportunities. And also it connected us to a number of different researchers that were doing research on digital platforms as well as digital infrastructures. I'm sure you know the special issue about at ISR published in 2018. A lot of people tell us even today that it was path-breaking. And I think it was path-breaking primarily because it was cross-disciplinary, right? And I think it brought a lot of different communities together. So that's how I ended up with digital platforms. And that special issue really opened up my eyes to the kind of research that was being done by people in strategic management and economics. as well as IS. And the definition that I use, I will use the definition that we used in that editorial, which is digital platforms are a set of digital resources that enable value-creating interactions between producers and consumers of different types of services. And that definition, in my view, is quite interesting because it's twofold, right? It makes reference to the technology stack, right? That there is a technology stack there. You cannot ignore the technology stack. There's a set of core components, and then those core components are interfaced with various standards, with a set of peripheral complements that are provided by third parties, right? So the technology stack is important. But in addition to that, the value creation element of it makes reference to a marketplace. That marketplace, I think, is what most people tend to refer to when they talk about digital platforms, right? The ability to invert the firm, to use some of the terms of my colleagues, to allow third parties to come in and complement, take over the risk of innovation, but also the value creation opportunities that are made possible through this technology stack. And therefore, you don't have a hierarchical organization calling all the shots. Rather have ecosystem aggregate dynamics between different ecosystem players, right? Third-party developers, advertisers, customers, etc. So that's my definition, and that's where I come from.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. When we were chatting before playing the recording, you mentioned a third dimension, or one that is interlinked with the technical stack and the marketplace, basically building the technical stack and operating the marketplace, which is the hub firm, and particularly the identity of the hub firm. And you shared the question of why digital platforms evolve, or that this is a question that that you're currently working on, why digital platforms evolve in the way they do. And there you put emphasis on the identity of the hub firm. Maybe you can elaborate a bit on that and share some insights on the interesting work that you have been doing in answering that question.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that. As I mentioned, right after that special issue, I started working with different people, and I've been very fortunate, to be honest, to work with very bright, very prolific people, much more prolific than I've ever been and I will ever be, I think. Together we started asking the question, we're inverting the firm, and the ecosystem does a lot of the work around value creation, and that's what makes platforms scale and evolve. But then we also started thinking, but then not all digital platforms are the same, right? They're not homogeneous. So what's interesting is that there has been a lot of research looking at platform governance. And in relation to that, the openness strategies. There have been a few key papers in the past that have talked about, how do you open up a platform? Meaning not just the technology stack, but also in relation to the marketplace, who do you allow to come into your marketplace, right? And those decisions, the openness decisions, affect how a platform scales. There's no denying that, right? So we understand how platforms scale. But we asked this question in relation to the heterogeneity that we were observing. So digital platforms often in the same marketplaces, right? Often in the same market category, using the same governance mechanisms, right? If you take the example of Apple and Google, for example, they use the same revenue share model. But then they evolve very differently. They have different evolutionary trajectories. So we said, well, we need to understand what's happening behind the scenes. Why are certain governance mechanisms being implemented at different points in time? And what are the effects of those governance mechanisms on the evolution of the platform? So we started going back to, and I mean, being an information scholar myself, we always look at the socio-technical aspect of you know, of change, of transformation, right? It's not just the technology, it's not just the market. It's a combination of both factors, and especially paying attention at the organizational dimension, right? So obviously these platforms are orchestrated by specific firms, right? They are not orchestrated by themselves. These are not decentralized. I mean, we're not talking about here the types of blockchain. I know you've had others talk about this and decentralized organizations, autonomous organizations. And it's a different type of organization, right? Here, we're talking about centralized organization. And that central authority is the hub firm behind the digital platform, right? So we thought that it's quite obvious to look at the firm. So we started looking at key statements, such as 10K forms that are filed annually, but also press releases that these companies release to the public. And we started looking at the ways they were describing themselves to not just the stakeholders like investors and regulators and their customers, but also to developers, right? Those very developers that made their platforms grow. And we realized that there were patterns of defining their key purpose and value proposition to those third parties, to the ecosystem actors that were participating on their digital platform. And those decisions were very much related to how the firm saw themselves in relation to those ecosystem partners. In other words, they chose which relationships to form and to strengthen. Some chose ecosystem actor A, others chose ecosystem actor B, right? And we know from experience, you know, the two major platforms, Apple and Google, Apple iOS and Google Android, Apple always pays attention to the end user, right? Their focus is always serving the customer, building customer experiences. Whereas with Google, being an open source platform, they always catered for, initially they said they catered also for the OEMs, for the original equipment manufacturers, and the third-party developers, providing open source tools for them to innovate more freely. So we see that there's their weight of, you know, managing those relationships varied significantly, and these went all the way back to the identity of their firm, right? Apple has always catered for the end user, the end consumer, whereas Google always catered for, you know, open source innovation, of course, always to benefit their own interest, which is to serve their advertising network and, you know, to use aggregation of data to monetize different types of services, not only on their own platform, but across platforms. So we essentially, we argue in that project that any actions or complements that are found to align with the identity of the firm, right, tend to be supported and reinforced. And those that are misaligned, they are excluded. And those alignment decisions, identity alignment decisions, tend to contribute to the evolution of the platform. And that's the first project. And I'll appear just in case you want to ask me any questions, and then I'll mention the second project.
Well, I think this is very interesting, this idea of studying platforms that are competing somehow and seeing how they evolve towards time. One of the things I've been questioning myself about is the kind of path dependency that might be there. Meaning that you were mainly referring to gigantic platforms that were created in a moment in which the concept of platform itself existed, but was definitely not mainstream, not a new dominant design not an alternative dominant design. And I was wondering, what's your opinion on the future big platforms to come? Do you think that this type of evolution is going to be still needed, that there might be differences in this direction? Or what's your thoughts on what's happening in a, more recently in time or even right now from this perspective?
Yeah, I mean, the issue of big tech obviously is something that is debated. And I think in the last 5 or so years, there has been a lot of research looking at regulation and antitrust issues, right? Especially with the initial proposal for the DMA, the Digital Markets Act, and then the implementation of the Digital Markets Act, and then other countries are following suit. Now, what's interesting, at least in our research, because we did archival analysis of data, as I said, 10K forms, press releases, developer blogs, even regulatory interventions into the history of these firms. And we saw that even in the case of regulatory interventions, there was a deliberate effort to reinterpret those regulatory interventions in light of the identity of those firms. In other words, you know, any responses to those interventions always came with the identity of the firm in mind. I mean, think of, for example, if I can use the example of Google, and how in 2018 the European Union came in and said, you are monopolizing search, and you are also anti-competitive in your practices when it comes to licensing open source components to different OEMs, including QIA, LG, Samsung, etc. So Google came in and said, okay, I will remain open source. I will still, you know, have open source licenses. And these licenses are flexible. And they use these terms. These are flexible licensing policies in the sense that you can choose how to reconfigure which components to take, which bundles of components to have pre-installed on your mobile device, but that would come with a cost. So in other words, I am still open source, irrespective of what you are saying, that I am acting as a monopoly and as a hierarchically integrated organization. Because essentially, the EU regulation said that, you know, you're integrating everything. You're becoming a monopoly, and you're creating winner-take-all markets by essentially, you know, acquiring and merging different components that become part of your ecosystem. So it's no longer open source. You say you license open source licenses, but you're in fact not. You're proprietary. So Google said, no, we are open source, but if you want to play this game, we're also going to play the game as well. We're going to charge you for the licenses that you want to buy from us, and that will also hinder your efforts to promote your apps and reach out customers if you choose not to bundle components in the way that we say components should be bundled. And of course, I'm talking about Google Play with Google Maps, with Google Search, with YouTube, that they had to unbundle because of the EU regulation, right? So what's interesting is that I think we're going to have more and more of these antitrust investigations, because they are becoming too big. These companies are becoming too big, and there's no question about it. But it's interesting to see how these companies are responding to those regulatory interventions, right? And obviously they want to protect their market interests, but they're doing so in a way that projects a particular identity to the ecosystem, right? Because remember, Google started as an open source provider, right? Of OS, of an app store, of different components, of different interfaces, even programming languages, right? And they're allowing cross-platform tools to be used on their platform. They don't want to alienate the third-party developers, because by alienating them, they could potentially lose them, right? So they don't want to be seen that we're changing the ways that we are structuring our platform. So they want to project that identity to the world, irrespective of whether that identity is contested by the ecosystem, right? So what we argue in that paper is that we need to understand both the ways that the Hub firm presents itself and positions itself in the market, as well as the tensions those positionings create and the way the ecosystem responds to those tensions in order to understand how these platforms evolve and how they scale over time. At least that's our take.
Yeah, I think that it's a very, very interesting perspective. And I have to admit that I am not super well read in organizational studies, and I had to look up a bit about organizational identification and identity in preparation of the call. And I found Albert and Wetton from 1985, who say that the identity encapsulates something that is central, the essence of the organization, something that is distinctive, distinguishing the organization from others, and something that is enduring, right? Some degree of sameness or continuity. The D3 form an organizational identity. And I think it's extremely interesting to especially look at the distinctiveness of the different approaches when building and operating a technical stack and forming a governance for a platform. And I was thinking, is there, for every multi-sided market, is there n being the number of sides, different identities that can thrive in a given domain with a differentiated approach to building a platform and serving one group of customers more than another? Because when I'm now thinking about what you said, Google being the one in the mobile operating system that was leaning towards open source and thus more approachable to the developer community, while Apple having this very, very integrated, this is probably also then a symptom of trying to deliver the best, the most consistent user experience by being integrated with the software and the hardware, for example, that now what we see in the in times of artificial intelligence and bringing these LLM applications to market, that Meta, interestingly enough, seems to be the one the most like open and the most transparent about what they do. Why Google had this seat for a while, and OpenAI focusing on user experience and getting more and more closed and productized, I would say, with the ChatGPT application. Is this something that you also looked into? What's your take?
Yeah. So we went through various iterations on this, and the more recent research on organizational identity acknowledges that some attributes remain core and distinctive and unique, but then you have other attributes that are adapting to changes in the market or in the relationships that a firm has with its different stakeholders, right? So the research on organizational identity actually talks about both change and continuity. And what we find is that some core attributes, like with Apple, you know, the serving the customer experience and trying to integrate, as you said, hardware and software in order to serve that customer experience remains core. But then, of course, there are changes. And we find that, you know, there are peripheral changes that do not affect the core identity, such as, for example, the recent turn by Apple in essentially making breaking their relationship with key complementors like Facebook and Google in relation to their advertising networks and building their own network, right? So that was a big shift in working with big developers like Google and Facebook, and then announcing that they're going to build their own advertising network because they realize the value of data. Now, obviously, companies are making changes to the way they operate to capture new opportunities, right? So it's not just about serving particular relationship with specific ecosystem actors, but also potentially stretching your market boundaries to take advantage of new opportunities. And these are the situations where there are tensions being created because on the one hand, you don't want to give the signal to your ecosystem that you're completely different, that you that would completely alienate, especially your more loyal customers and even your partners. But at the same time, you don't want to be seen that you're falling behind with the trend while some of your competitors are doing more interesting things with technology. So this tension is always what drives these adaptations to the identity. But we argue that the core identity often remains the same.
I'm very aligned with your last sentence. I truly believe that platforms must have, well, I tend to talk about value proposition more than identity, but I see these two concepts aligned. And we believe that a platform should have a central value proposition that is then declined towards the various sites, towards the various services, but always keeping a very strong coherence with the central one. Listening to your words, I was kind of thinking about a situation for platforms that is in my opinion, pretty paradoxical. So I was wondering if you have an opinion on that. We started talking about platform evolution, and I think that naturally, due to the network externalities, platforms need to evolve, to grow, to include more sites, to become bigger, because that's the way in which they actually capture value and make value out of the way in which they create value. At the same time, the more they grow, especially into different fields, into different industries, the more we see obvious and direct threats to competition and to new platforms that can come in. What's your take on this kind of paradoxical tension between letting them grow and controlling them in certain ways, whatever it means?
Yeah, well, that gives me a cue, the perfect cue for my second project, in fact. So there's a second project that looks at, again, the evolution of platforms, but this this project focuses in particular on the timing of open innovation strategies to develop and sustain dominant designs. And I'm sure you've crossed earlier research on dominant designs, how dominant designs emerge. That research primarily focused on products, right? What we find is that even though there's a lot of research that looked at the timing of entry and how much time do incumbents have to resist disruption by new entrants and so on and so forth, what is missing is what happens when a digital platform is dominant, but then there is a reversal, right? So from becoming dominant through open innovation to being disrupted by new digital platform, right? So this is an important phenomenon that only anecdotally, I think we've discussed it in the research, right? We know that, for example, MySpace was dominant and was disrupted by Facebook. Or, you know, you mentioned prior to this conversation when we were initially talking, you mentioned Twitter and how Twitter now is maybe facing the risk of being disrupted, even though Facebook didn't manage to do that with their own app. So what we, just to give you a little bit of context, we're studying the evolution of online FX retail platforms. This is a nascent ecosystem, right? This is especially back in 2005 when FX, at least the retail aspect of FX trading, started taking place online, because previously it was all done by banks and by institutional brokers, right? Whereas now anyone can go online, open up an account and start trading foreign exchange. So one of the biggest players in this space is MetaTrader. You probably know about it, right? So the company is actually based in Cyprus. And we did interviews with 100 chief executives or so from brokers, liquidity providers, retail traders, third-party developers of components, etc. Because what's interesting there is that MetaTrader 4 became the dominant platform of the industry. Everyone's using MetaTrader 4. From 2005 all the way to 2015 or so, they had like approximately 80% of the market. And the reason why they became so dominant, they followed, I would say, very similar approach to Microsoft in the 90s. They sold white label licenses. That's what they call it, white label, to different brokers. And there were some limitations with the technology stack as to how many transactions you could have. But then each trader was buying additional licenses and getting more trade. Each broker was buying additional licenses and then getting more traders and so on and so forth. So you can imagine little empires being built. You have banks that acted both as liquidity providers and brokers, and at the same time had thousands of traders underneath them. And in places like Asia, you had great gray label licensing, where these were licenses that were not formally bought by MetaQuotes, but MetaQuotes didn't care because that essentially allowed them to diffuse more widely into different markets, which is exactly the approach that Microsoft took with their Windows back in the 90s. You know, there were pirated copies of Windows going around. Microsoft didn't care because that was the way to be diffused everywhere, right? And they got like 90% of all enterprise licenses across the world. Something similar happened with MetaQuotes, right? But what happened, what's interesting is that MetaQuotes was only developing the core platform, the trading platform, and very efficient. The guy that actually owns the company is a software developer, and he cares about the code. He doesn't care about anything else, at least according to our interviews. But what happened over time was that there was fragmentation, right? And the literature talks about this, right? If you become too open, at some point, your platform becomes fragmented because there's so many different components flowing around, and many of those components don't interoperate, right? So MetaQuote started getting calls from customers saying, you know, my client is using X, component application to run, you know, algorithmic trading, and it's not interfacing with that other client that also heard about it, and now they want to integrate it onto their system, and we have a big problem. So MetaQuote said, well, it's not my problem. I mean, you bought it from that third party. Why should I care? But then, you know, these big companies, right? And we're talking banks now that, you know, they're transacting trillions over their platforms. They started contracting out, and some even started building their own platforms internally and integrating those components onto their platforms and then selling them directly to clients. So now it's becoming a big problem, right? Because those other versions of MetaTrader 4 were becoming more powerful than MetaTrader 4, at least for the clients that had the knowledge, the money, and the resources to customize those platforms according to their needs. So MetaQuotes came back and said, well, you know, we're going to build MetaTrader 5. And with MetaTrader 5, they started to integrate everything. They did enveloping, right? To use a term from the literature, they enveloped a lot of features. They created a lot of components. They tried to build both the front end and the back end, because one of the criticisms was that MetaTrader 4 never had a back end that would integrate with enterprise systems within an organization. This was a customer-facing platform. So they started doing all that. And then they started saying, well, you know, come to MetaTrader 5 because it offers additional functionality. And in fact, it's a greater product. It is a greater product. It's a much more features, more integration, as I said. But no one's moving. And that's the interesting a phenomenon that we're studying. We're trying to understand, okay, you have now two platforms. You have MetaTrader 4 that's dominant in the industry, but it's completely fragmented. And then you have MetaTrader 5 that it's a better product, but no one wants to switch to it. So they have, I think they have like 88% of the market there, and then 72% of the market on MetaTrader 4. Maybe these figures are not exactly this at the moment, but and now they even gradually they started saying, we're going to phase out support to MetaTrader 4, and we're going to phase out also giving out licenses to MetaTrader 4 because they want to make a hard push to migrate everyone to MetaTrader 5. So it's an interesting case of timing your dominance, right? So we are asking the questions, first, when should have MetaQuotes stopped white labeling and demanded that there would be no extensions to their platform? At which point should have that taken place? And then looking forward, how do you switch to a more dominant platform and close everything up without losing your opportunity to capture value in the way that you were capturing value with your old platform? In words, without losing your market share and not alienating your customers. So this is a very big question. It's a very complex space, I should say. There's so many different products. The way money flows around, it's complicated. There's a lot of dependencies between the different ecosystem actors and so on and so forth. But we're focusing primarily on the technology stack and the governance decisions that the platform made over time to understand exactly what you mentioned, Daniel, you know, this paradox. You know, you want to grow, but at the same time, you want to control, because if you don't control, you end up with fragmentation, and potentially you may also end up with losing a lot of the value that you have captured over the years and becoming obsolete. I mean, there is a risk of becoming obsolete if you completely lose control over your platform.
That the example reminds me of the cases that we, or the case reminds me of the cases that we discussed before, because I think for Android, this is what I know from the work that we have been doing with our company, where we also build software using Android as an open source system. And Android distinguishes between officially supported devices that can get access to official Android services and products, for example, the Google Play App Store, while you can also have an unofficial, not supported Android that you can still use. But if you want to have, for example, a shop system and applications for your users, you need to build it yourself. And other products and services are also not included. Like, for example, in our case, building on mobile devices, that includes a localization service where Google offers you improvements for the GPS position, which sounds trivial, but if you have to do this for a mobile on your own, it's a hell lot of work. And there are some, I would say, quote unquote, killer features in the officially supported Android stack that are really, really expensive for everyone using the unofficial stack. So the question would be, is this also true already for MetaTrader 4? It sounded a bit that the company was kind of overwhelmed and not super strategic when it came to the deciding or influencing what do I give out as a white label and what maybe can I keep proprietary. This is, as I understand it, now implemented in the fifth version. Or was this already in place in MetaTrader 4, that they had some, let's say, proprietary components, some proprietary services that you could only access as a user by working with the, like directly with the firm? Or was it that you could basically take the whole stack, replicate and adapt it to your context in the fourth version?
No, the core platform could not be changed, but they allowed open source interfaces to be built so that third-party complements could be added to the platform. So then there were different configurations on MetaTrader 4 depending on which broker you went to. That was the problem. I mean, the core platform remained the same. And the reason why it was so successful, it was because of the speed of transaction. I mean, the speed of transaction, which, you know, requires like milliseconds to perform, made a huge difference to all traders. And this is why traders preferred it the first place. So the core platform remained the same. The problem was configuring the bunch of other complements that as the ecosystem grew, remember, this was a nascent ecosystem, right? Retail FX trading didn't exist prior to this. So as it was growing, people were demanding more things. And therefore, the components that came with the platform were being expanded as well based on the needs of these new clients, right? I think it's an interesting case of emergence of both the industry or the ecosystem, but also the platform itself.
So Panos, we started looking backward. You told us your very early steps in the world of platforms. You brought us through two of your most recent and most relevant projects. My next question is looking ahead. So what's coming? What's working on? What's going to be relevant in your opinion that you are focusing your attention on?
Yeah, so I'm doing a few projects at the moment focusing on data, and in particular also data policy. Data policies at the regulatory level, but also at the level of platforms. So there's one project that I'm involved that looks at the impact of GDPR on platform competition between developers on the same platform, but also between developers and the platform owner. And here we're looking at things like different types of apps, like free versus paid. As you know, with the free apps, it's very much dependent on data, because from the data, then they can generate advertising revenue. Whereas with the paid apps, it's a different setup. But also how developers choose to multi-home and whether they choose to multi-home or not, depending on these types of policies, whether it's GDPR at the regulatory level or whether it's ATT, the app tracking transparency that was implemented by Apple and has affected the way that developers choose to develop apps for Apple, or whether to monohome or single home for other types of platforms. And that there's a couple of projects there that I'm doing with different colleagues. I'm not leading on those projects, but those are very interesting. And then I think you also know about the Gaia X project that was published in a book chapter, where we're looking at the case of ecosystems in the making, right? So before these ecosystems are formed, we argue that there's no centralized body. And therefore, the different ecosystem partners have to figure out the terms of participation, right? And we argue that controlling data becomes a bottleneck. It's a bottleneck both in relation to how innovation takes place, but also how value creation takes place, and by extension, who captures some of that value. So in that paper, we looked at the formation of GAIAEC, which is a federated cloud-based ecosystem that was launched under a European initiative and brings together research, commercial partners, but also the government, some government institutions from across Europe, who were on different sectors, right? From agriculture, from manufacturing, etc. The whole idea is to enable collaboration between these different partners to foster innovation. And we basically show how defining how control data control is coordinated across these different partners can help resolve some market failures, and also help the ecosystem partners co-specialize. What we talk about when we talk about complementarities at the ecosystem level, we argue that prior to having those complementarities, you need to negotiate how data is controlled, because if you don't do that, there will be no agreement as to how these partners collaborate and therefore, by extension, develop complementarity. So that project is interesting because it was more, it was based on secondary data, but there's another project that builds on that, that looks at cloud-based federated ecosystems again in the banking sector, looking at how different partners negotiate data control agreements prior to beginning to innovate. So this is a step back prior to, you know, the value creation interactions that you observe on digital platforms.
Yeah, thank you so much for walking us through the different projects that all have as a common denominator, I feel, the question, how do they evolve, right? From like quite early as a data ecosystem to the company in the MetaTrader 4 case that is in the, I would say, it's quite mature, but in a nascent ecosystem or in a nascent context, and evolving and thinking about how to gain back control in a way, and then the very mature platforms and looking at the identity of the firm. Super interesting conversation. For me, I learned a lot. I have a ton of notes. One final thought that I'd like to share, because it was also mentioned, the case of decentralized platforms. And when I think at the identity of the hub firm and the role of the identity of the hub firm, especially when it comes to delivering a superior user experience, I think this is something that these decentralized platforms couldn't crack yet. I don't know if they ever will. Because there it's mainly about the developers, right? They are the ones building or using the building blocks, building the platform, running the platform, while there's no central entity that's really end-to-end caring about the user. At least this is what I haven't seen yet. So extremely interesting, extremely relevant work. Panos, before we close, because we're already at the end of the time for this interview, What is the best way for our listeners to follow your work, to stay up to date, and maybe get in touch if they want to learn more about your upcoming projects?
Well, you know, I think you can include my email address to the podcast if anyone's interested. I can also share some of the papers. Not the working papers, but the ones that have been published. And I would be happy to connect with anyone that's interested to finding out more about these projects.
Very good. We will, of course, include everything in the show notes. And with that, Panos, thank you so much for spending your time with us, sharing your exciting work, and just the best for everything that's coming. Great to have you.
Thank you, Daniel, and thank you, Philip. It's been a pleasure. Very interesting discussion. Thank you for the questions.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.